Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome Dr. Michael Allen, a rheumatologist at Albany Med, where he treats patients with scleroderma, sarcoidosis, rheumatoid arthritis-associated interstitial lung disease, and general rheumatic conditions, including lupus, gout, psoriatic arthritis. He completed a fellowship in rheumatology at Columbia University Irving Medical Center and a residency in internal medicine at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, both in New York City. He earned his medical degree from the American Medical Program at Tel Aviv University in Israel. If you have a question for Dr. Allen today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Michael Allen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Give me the Cliff Notes, very quick version for everyone listening who has no idea what rheumatology is, what it is, and how it affects the immune system of all of us.
Yeah, so rheumatology is a subspecialty of internal medicine. So as you kind of went through there in the bio, everyone that is a practicing rheumatologist has completed a residency in internal medicine. And beyond that residency has done a fellowship or additional training in the field of rheumatology. In rheumatology, I kind of break into two specific broad fields. We treat a lot of joint diseases. So that's, you know, arthritis. Gout is a good example of that. Psoriatic arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. And then we treated a wide variety of autoimmune conditions. So some of those conditions I just mentioned are autoimmune. For example, rheumatoid arthritis, a condition in which the immune system starts detecting the body's joint tissue as foreign and causes a lot of inflammation, swelling, stiffness. And then a wide variety of other autoimmune diseases like vasculitis, sarcoidosis, scleroderma. These are all diseases in which the immune system has kind of turned against the individual who has the disease. And we don't fully understand all the reasons why that happens, but we are in charge of diagnosing and treating those conditions.
How has the understanding of autoimmune illnesses changed or improved? You're pretty young, but over the decades. In other words, it seems very mysterious to me. The immune system, ostensibly, it's a very good thing to have, but it goes too far. And so you said just now it's something of a mystery. Have we gained any knowledge, any insights over the past 25, 30 years?
We've gained massive amounts of insight. So there's still a mysterious underpinning to the diseases. And what I tell people when I see them in the office is, if they're being diagnosed with an autoimmune disease for the first time, is it's a very common question is, why did I get this or how did this happen? These are diseases I treat adults. There are pediatric rheumatologists, but the great majority of people who are diagnosed with a rheumatic disease are adults. And what we tell them is there's a genetic underpinning to the disease, meaning some complex combination of your genes contributes to you being predisposed to having the disease. But your genes, your genetics do not change throughout the course of your life. So something happens to the immune system that essentially activates it in a way that changes it. Your immune system's normal job is to protect you from infection, outside entities, viruses, bacteria, fungi, and keep you safe. It is supposed to detect your tissues as being you and anything else as being foreign and get rid of anything foreign. Something happens to the immune system in a genetically predisposed individual with a immune stimulus of some kind. Now, what's that stimulus? There's a lot of theory about that. Maybe infection. There could be climate-related triggers or stimuli. Illnesses can trigger the immune system. Stress can trigger the immune system. A lot of different things can trigger the immune system. But in any given individual, it's very hard to figure out what that thing was. But at some point, the immune system is triggered to be overactive and starts detecting the tissues that previously were not being noticed by the immune system to being attacked. And that can be the joints, that can be the lungs, that can be the heart, that can really be any part of the body, the kidneys. And depending on where that immune system activation happens, that's where the manifestations of the disease come. So I have not been practicing for 25 or 30 years.
No.
We have gained a tremendous amount of information about the immune system in that time. So a condition like rheumatoid arthritis is a good example. So rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease. It affects about 1% of adults. It has been recognized for a long period of time. And 40, 50 years ago, the treatments were really very few. People were put on steroids. People were put on gold, methotrexate, a couple of older medications that were used to treat rheumatoid arthritis. If you turn the television on, you know, this weekend to watch college basketball, you'll see about 25 advertisements for medications that are used for treating rheumatoid arthritis. And those are very targeted medications at molecules that no one knew what they were 30 years ago. So tumor necrosis factor is an example of that. There are many medicines that directly attack tumor necrosis factor. Janus kinase is another one. These are molecules that contribute to inflammation that we now know are present in people with autoimmune diseases. Now, why are they overactivated? Why are they overexpressed? That's a little bit of a different question. But we certainly are much better at treating the conditions than we were, you know, even 20 years ago.
I mean, I'm glad you mentioned all the medications and the endless ads for these different medications. The one universal property of all these is the side effects will scare the bejesus out of you. Why is it that something designed to do something good is possibly, and again, it may be a very small percentage of patients who get these side effects, but you don't want some of these.
So, yeah, there's a number of reasons for that, to answer that question. I mean, in any given individual, I will tell them that you want to be on every medication that you need and no medication that you don't. And certainly if you do not have one of these conditions or you don't have the condition that's serious enough to warrant a risky medication, then certainly you should not be on the risky medication. That probably goes without saying, but is important. So you don't want to just be taking these medications with, you know, if they're not necessary. However, in any given individual, if they have very debilitating disease, whether that's rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, whatever, psoriatic arthritis, that prevents you from doing your day-to-day activities, all of a sudden, the benefits versus the risks of the medication, that balance certainly starts to push towards benefit. The risks really of these are pretty safe medications. I know that can come off as untrue in the ad because the ad spends about 5 minutes talking about all the possible negatives. But there's a large legal side to that, too.
Yeah, a lawyer
more,
to death.
More of a protection in these very, very uncommon cases where people do develop very serious side effects. That certainly can happen, but it is quite rare.
You know, one of the universals is, you know, if you have TB or if you have any infection at all, this is dangerous stuff. So this, as I understand it, my guess is these drugs basically reduce the body's ability to fight infections.
That's the general gist of all of the medications. They all work in a slightly different way, but their job, given that the diseases are diseases of the immune system being overactive, are to suppress the immune system in some manner.
So we get the cost-benefit analysis here, because if you get something else, if you get another infection.
And it's a very common thing where people do get infections. That's a part of life that happens in people who are on these medications. And it's more common in people who are on these medications. They get more infections than people who are not. But of course, it's part of regular life for everyone who's not on an immune-suppressing drug as well. So the drugs are generally not taken during those times. And everything is one of the beauties of my job is having the opportunity to weigh the benefits versus the risk in any given individual in any given person. Is this medicine worth being on or is it not worth being on? And that is kind of the nature of the job.
We're joined today by Dr. Michael Allen, a rheumatologist at Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And, Doc, we got a couple of emails here, so let's do these first, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. Tom in Gardner, Massachusetts writes, could you talk about PMR, symptoms, treatment, progression? First, tell me what PMR is.
So PMR stands for polymyalgia rheumatica. It's an autoimmune disease that affects adults over the age of 50. You really don't see it in younger people. It's a condition that causes a lot of joint stiffness, swelling, particularly in the large joints. You know, some diseases affect the large joints, some diseases affect the small joints, some affect both. This tends to cause a lot of shoulder, neck, hip, pelvic girdle stiffness. The most common thing you will hear is, you know, difficulty getting out of bed in the morning. And I'm not talking about, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of feeling a little bit stiff. I mean, truly hours of being unable to move for the person to get moving. It's like all these conditions, there's a wide variety. Some are in any given disease, there's the severity is very variable. So in some cases, it's pretty mild. People have mild joint stiffness that improves with an hour or two of time. Others, I've seen people who have had PMR that's been untreated for maybe a month or two, and they really are unable to walk much at all because of how stiff the hips and the pelvis is. So usually the progression is variable. The progression depends on how it's treated and how well someone responds to the medication. The most common treatment for the PMR is steroids. steroids are extremely effective. The typical kind of teaching of PMR is if someone comes to their primary care doctor, they're 70 years old, they were feeling well 2 months ago, but now they have a lot of stiffness in the morning in the hips, a lot of stiffness in the morning in the shoulders. They have elevated markers of inflammation in their blood. You put the person on 15 milligrams of prednisone, and the next day the person feels 100% better. Like, they have a dramatic response to steroids within a very brief period of time. That's the very classic kind of manifestation of and progression of PMR. Steroids have a lot of positives. They're very strong general anti-inflammatory medicines. They've been around a long time. They are, unfortunately, have a number of serious side effects if you're on them for a long period of time. So the issue with the PMR that's being asked in this question is what else can you do for it that isn't steroids? Because unfortunately, being on steroids for lifelong is really not a good option. PMR does have other medications that are used to treat it: methotrexate, sarilumab, which is a medicine called Kevzara that was approved a couple years ago for the treatment of polymyalgia rheumatica. It's an injectable medicine. There are other medicines. All of their goal is to get you off of the prednisone as soon as humanly possible. The strange thing about PMR is it does tend to get better with time. So usually after a year or two, people can come off of the medicine. It's not usually a condition that requires lifelong medication. And as far as progression, if you're on the medications, it usually is manageable. It does not always go all the way away, and some people need to be on lifelong medication. But the majority of people can come off of PMR medicine within a couple of years. The general treatment would be steroids for 6 to 12 months, maybe another medication for a couple of years beyond that. And usually people do quite well.
Is it fair to say that your job is managing symptoms and not curing? Are there cures involved?
I can't think of a condition that I cure in the classic sense. You know, if you have a UTI and you go on antibiotics, you are cured of that UTI. We manage these conditions. They're chronic diseases. We manage the disease. Sometimes that means managing the symptoms. Sometimes that means managing, at the more cellular base level of the immune system. But yes, unfortunately, cures for lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, PMR, we do not have anything. You know, there's some emerging treatments for very severe diseases like dermatomyositis and scleroderma and lupus, like CAR T-cell therapy, which is also used for some cancers.
Yeah.
That looks like potentially it could cure some of our diseases, but that is future directions, not something that's widely available now.
Well, let's take a quick break here. Dr. Michael Allen joins us from Albany Med. It's rheumatology, 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Hey, check it out. Vox Pop's gardening show is on the road April 22nd. That's Earth Day at the Landis Arboretum. It's a fun show. People like the gardening show. I've never gardened a day in my life, and I even like the gardening show. I'll be there. Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, Dale Eitheriggs. We'll talk Bob into it if we can. You can be part of the audience. You can ask questions. We'll be recording it live and airing it on Memorial Day. Find out more. It's April 22nd. Just go to wamc.org/on the road. This is Vox Pop, and it's 800-348-2551 if you have a rheumatology question for Dr. Michael Allen. And we had a couple that came in really early today. So just two more emails here, and then we'll jump to the phones. This is from Allie. I'd love your general perspective on a scenario. If a 65-year-old patient with long-standing advanced rheumatoid arthritis has been experiencing recurrent pneumonia that leads to hospitalization each time, and there's concern that the RA may be affecting the lungs, how do specialists usually evaluate and manage that if standard RA treatments haven't been effective and a physician is considering rituximab? How do you weigh the risks in someone who's already having frequent infections? Are there other treatment strategies or evaluations you typically consider first when there may be pulmonary involvement?
Yeah, it's a really excellent question about a very detailed particular case. So just to set the framework, a lot of these autoimmune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, which is primarily a disease that affects the joints, they are systemic diseases. They cause inflammation not just in the joints, but in other parts of the body, and the lung is certainly one of the places where that can happen. And in rheumatoid arthritis, interstitial lung disease, which is an inflammatory condition that causes inflammation and then scarring in a piece of the lung, can affect people's ability to breathe. They cause shortness of breath. They can require oxygen, et cetera. So the question is about a person who's had rheumatoid arthritis for a long period of time. It sounds like likely has interstitial lung disease or some rheumatic pulmonary manifestation of their rheumatoid arthritis. and the medicines that they have been on have not been effective for treating the rheumatoid arthritis. So what do you do with such a person? And even this is a part of rheumatology where honestly the field has changed even within the last 5 years. So when I was a fellow and learning, you know, how to manage these cases, the general thinking was that, well, if you're treating the rheumatoid arthritis well and the person's joints are good, that's adequate. Their lungs will be fine. That has, we've come to find that's not really true. The process that's going on in the joint is not necessarily the process that's going on in the lung. And in this case, it's sort of the opposite. The joint medicine has not worked very well. It sounds like the person's joints are very advanced and it's been very severe. And unfortunately, even with all the new medicines we have, a lot of people do unfortunately still have very aggressive and kind of debilitating rheumatoid arthritis. What do you do with that person's medicine as far as their lungs go? It depends. I mean, if there are medications like mycophenolate that are used that are not actually effective joint medications that can work to treat autoimmune disease in the lung, the medicine specifically that's mentioned there, rituximab, is an infusion medicine. It's given usually every 6 months and is a very aggressive immune-suppressing medication that does work well for rheumatoid arthritis. It also works well for the lung. I can't speak, obviously, specifically to this individual case right. about what do you do? Do you do rituximab or not? The general thinking would be if the person's constantly getting sick with bacterial pneumonia, probably the risks of being on rituximab are too high. However, if the thinking is that the lung findings that they're looking at are, you know, the nodules or the changes on the CAT scan of the lung are from rheumatoid arthritis and that treating that might improve the lung function, then it might be worth, a trial of going on to the infusion, seeing how it goes. The problem with some of the infusion medicines is especially something like rituximab, it can't be stopped once you've started it. It's, you know, you're committed as a, you know, you're kind of pot committed to it once you've started it for at least a few months.
Is that a poker reference?
That is a poker reference.
Wow.
So you're pot committed once you've started the rituximab. You can't take it out. And therefore, you know, you do have to consider the age of the person, the debility of the person, how much risk the person's willing to undergo in order to potentially get better. And that's part of medical decision making too. How much are you willing to do for the potential of getting better, knowing that there's significant risk associated?
Dr. Michael Allen joins us here today, a rheumatologist at Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551, and I'll get to the phones right away. One last question here that came in much earlier. Have you experienced Lyme contributing to or being mistaken for arthritis?
Oh, gosh, all the time.
Yeah.
Lyme is a growing issue in this part of the country, really nationwide, but certainly in the Northeast. The tick population is increasing. The frequency with which ticks are infected with Lyme is increased. Lyme is a bacterial infection, and it can cause a lot of joint pain and swelling. And that can look a lot like an autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, polymyalgia rheumatica. It can look a lot like that. So if I were a person who had never had joint pain before, had never had significant joint pain, and all of a sudden developed it, certainly in the warm months, I would certainly be thinking about getting a Lyme test in addition to looking into issues related to rheumatoid arthritis and other rheumatic diseases. The hard part that can come up is, you know, there's a lot of debate around what's called chronic Lyme, people who've had Lyme and have sequelae of that go on for years. Is that a rheumatic disease? Does that need to be treated with more antibiotics? The general thinking is no. Lyme, we think when you treat it in the general medical community, if you've treated it with antibiotics, you've been treated and it doesn't need to continually being treated. The tricky part, we were talking about the immune system. Lyme has a large impact on the immune system. You make lots of different antibodies in reaction to Lyme, and that can make it look like you have Lyme forever. But remember that it's worth remembering that the antibodies in people's immune systems can last for a long time, even well beyond when they've had an infection that's been treated.
Dr. Michael Allen joins us today. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. What's your poker game?
I used to play Texas Hold'em when I was college student.
Are you good?
Yeah. not particularly.
Oh, good.
No, I haven't done it like that.
I'll bring cards next time you're on the air. Let's see. Mary's in Marlboro, Vermont. Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I there?
Yeah, you sure are.
Thank you very much. So I'm calling, I just heard you talking about PMR. I was diagnosed about 3 years ago. I was having an unusual attack of stiffness. And actually, I went to the doctor because I was due for a carpal tunnel surgery. I was a pre-op. They did a blood test, and the C-related, C-reactive protein number, right?
Mm-hmm.
The PA who took me in said, well, you're stiff. It's probably just, cervical.
We lost
cervical
you.
Stenosis.
Mm-hmm. Cervical
stenosis.
But when
the blood test came back, the CPI, you know, the
CRP,
the inflammatory, that number, was supposed to be under 3. It was 109. And she freaked out and put me on prednisone, not knowing what it was. A week later, that was tested again, and it was the C-reactive protein was down to 11. 3 days later, it was under 3. It never went up again. But by that time, they told me I couldn't stop taking the prednisone. And I don't think that it was, in fact, truly, I keep wanting to say CPR, PMR. And just recently, I learned that my family, my father's family, definitely has, well, what they called it back in the 1800s, inflammatory rheumatism, which affected some of them and seriously and had lung issues and everything. But now I finally got off the prednisone, and I'm pretty much finally getting that out of my system. But I still have a lot of pain in my shoulders. But I don't have anything like enlarged joints or anything. I don't have those symptoms. Yeah. I don't have those. But I don't know. I can't find anybody.
Okay.
So PMR does not always cause a ton of swelling in the joints. So the theory PMR
but
is not crazy.
Then they said it was RA. Then they said, well, maybe it's not PMR, but it's RA.
Okay.
But I want to know if there's some way I can find a rheumatologist and how to explain to them that I think that there is some kind of autoimmune.
Okay.
There is arthritis in my family, and I can't seem to find anybody who will just not want to put me back on prednisone.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Now, remember, this is not a booking service on this show.
No. I'm just trying to figure out how to present to somebody in a way that they will take it seriously.
Understood. All right, Doc, what do you think?
So I think I don't think it'll be difficult to get someone to take you seriously, right? You have a CRP of 100. So to give the background on that, CRP is a marker of inflammation in the blood. There's two main ones that people check, which is a CRP, which stands for C-reactive protein, and an ESR, which stands for erythrocyte sedimentation rate. They are both generic markers of inflammation in the blood. If you have an infection, they'll be high. If you're on some medications, they'll be high. If you have other conditions, they can be high. So having a high CRP is not in and of itself, you know, diagnostic of any sort of rheumatic disease. But someone with a CRP of 100 and something is going to get people's attention. The question of how do you get on something else or get evaluated to be on something that isn't prednisone honestly is going to be getting referred to a rheumatologist, because the reality is in the orthopedic community and certainly in the primary care community, I mean, someone could treat you for PMR with steroids. That would be normal in the primary care. They're not going to do a ton of these kind of targeted biologic medicines because it's not within their scope of practice. So that would be coming to see us.
Okay. Mary, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Michael Allen joins us from Albany Med. Let's go to Albany. Brady's on. Brady, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, yep. Go ahead.
Perfect. So my question is related to acquired C1 esterase deficiency. I've had a few family members and people in my life go through extremely stressful events that have actually led to them going to the emergency room with severe angioedema, not thinking it's an anaphylactic reaction, and then later on they get diagnosed with an acquired C1 esterase deficiency that is supposedly related to these extreme stress. And I'm just wondering, like, how common is that? Because I've had 3 people in my life who have severe experience this, and what does management look like? Because in terms of, like, preventing these events, and how common this is, because they all go in with, like, almost like airway emergencies, and it's all related to severe stress in their life. So just curious on your opinion on it.
Okay.
So C1 esterase deficiency is, I would say, rheumatology adjacent. It's kind of it's obviously immune deficiency more than it is a kind of inflammatory condition, and it does tend to fall under the purview of kind of allergy immunology, which I know can, you know, immunology is certainly related to rheumatology, but it does tend to fall to their treatment. The question of how common is that and how many people have 3 people in their life with C1 esterase deficiency, I would say not very common. It's not it's not a common condition. These anaphylactic kind of angioedema, severe allergic type reactions where there's airway compromise, you know, swelling of the eyelids, that sort of thing, or lip swelling.
They get fresh frozen plasma and it clears right out.
Yeah. So that is good to know now, but obviously it's hard to know before the first time. So it does take time to get diagnosed. You know, it's once you know, but before you know, it's difficult. So as far as, you know, what causes C1 esterase deficiency? I honestly don't know the answer to that. And as far as how you kind of evaluate it for yourself going forward or other family members in your life, everyone's going to tell them to avoid the triggers. And I tell people this with autoimmune diseases all the time. And I say before I say it, that this, you know, can come off almost as condescending. It's like you do need to reduce stress in your life. You do need to exercise more. You do need to eat well, you know, love your family, do these kind of lifestyle things that will make your, that will reduce the frequency of flare-ups. Now, that's a lot easier said than done, but that does make a massive difference because it's a lot easier to prevent an episode of angioedema with, if indeed stress reduction will do it, than it is to have to go to the hospital and get, you know, FFP. So I hope that sort of answers that question.
Brady, thanks for the call. And I'm only suspecting, but I think that Brady had the speakerphone on. Sometimes it's unavoidable, but in general, if you can, when you call in, use the handset. It sounds much cleaner. If you can't, you can't. I understand. But that's generally the rule here. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Michael Allen joins us. And let's go to Troy, New York. And Karen, you're on.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I think my daughter Allie called a little bit ago and had questions regarding me. I've got RA for over 35 years. And
okay.
I'm trying to get an appointment with Dr. Allen's office. They're extremely busy.
Okay.
I sent in all the pre-approvals and my history.
Yes.
And like my daughter mentioned, I've actually been in the hospital 11 inpatient visits with pneumonia. Other things have happened alongside of that, diverticulitis.
Right.
Extreme reflux disease.
Okay.
I'm wondering, is there something I can take in the meantime besides the prednisone? I'm taking Rinvoq. That doesn't seem to be working at all. What can I do in the meantime until I can get an appointment with your office? Please.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so it's hard for me to really give you advice in that. We can certainly work on getting you into the office. That I think is something we can do. But the you know, as far as the, I would hesitate to give you recommendations. One, I can't prescribe you medicine without knowing you. And two, it's hard for me to really say your doctor should be doing this in X, Y, or Z situation. It's very tough for me to give that kind of advice, you know, without sight unseen.
You know, Karen brings up a great point, though. A lot of the specialists, you're a specialist, we need more of them, right? Isn't that a problem? You book something out and they say, well, we can't see it till 27.
I would be surprised if any listener hasn't had that issue, not only really with specialty care, but with including primary care in the community. It's an issue that, you know, is not unique to the capital region of New York. It's a national.
So what happened?
So I don't think it's actually that complicated. I mean, there's not been a massive expansion in terms of medical doctors that are produced in a given year since the mid-70s. There is a few new medical schools, but not many. There is a growing population. That population is getting older. The average, you know, adult now over 60 is seeing 3 to 4 specialists and a primary doctor, whereas previously that was all done really by one person. So this massive expansion in what we're able to do, what we're able to diagnose, what we're able to test, has not really been met with a workforce equivalent. There's certainly been expansion in the number of advanced practice providers, so that's nurse practitioners and PAs, which have been a humongous, you know, help in terms of offloading some of the volume.
Yeah.
But the reality is this, again, not an Albany specific issue, but a national issue, that there is a disconnect between the number of patients and the number of providers.
How do we fix it, man?
I think that APP, given that you can't just all of a sudden create a bunch of new doctors, you know, quickly, we do need to do that. The medical schools are trying to expand. Albany Medical College is growing the number of doctors every year in terms of their, you know, their graduating class, and we're all trying to do that locally. But that's going to take a lot of time. So in the meantime, it's going to probably be leaning more on the advanced practice providers, getting their education in terms of these subspecialties increased so that they're able to take on some of these more complicated cases.
So fewer people are making the leap to go to medical school?
Medical school is just as competitive now as it was.
Okay.
The medical school classes are filled, but a medical school class in the U.S. is somewhere in the range of 120 students per year that are graduating. That was the same 25 years ago.
Okay.
But the number of people that are over 65 is much higher now. Uh-huh. People live longer now. So maybe people over 80 is larger now than it was then.
So we're blaming the old people, basically.
It's not a no one's fault. It's great. We've people's life expectancy has increased over the last 20 years. But the longer people live, the more diseases they accumulate, and the number of providers that they have increases. And if there's not more providers, you have a mismatch.
Are you regretting being on the show yet?
No, I'm enjoying
really?
It.
All right, fair enough. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Michael Allen is our guest from Albany Med. We'll be back. Lovely. It's Thad Jones. Quiet Sip here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's do a couple emails, and then we'll go back to the phones. Dr. Michael Allen, our guest from Albany Med. Dave writes in, is lupus an autoimmune disease?
Lupus is absolutely an autoimmune disease. It's kind of a quintessential autoimmune disease in that it causes activation of the immune system in a number of different ways. The immune system is pretty complicated. There's lots of different cells, lots of tissues, and lupus is a disease that can cause inflammation really in any part of the body. So, it's a very broad disease, very heterogeneous in terms of how it presents, meaning that everyone's lupus is a little bit different. So the most common symptoms of lupus are joint pain, swelling, rash, fatigue, but the most serious manifestations of the condition are when it affects the kidneys, which is called lupus nephritis. It can affect the lungs. It can affect the heart. It tends to be more aggressive in younger people. It's a condition that, unfortunately, children can get as well. So it is, yes, it is absolutely an autoimmune disease.
This is from Bill, and I'm not sure this is in your line of work here. Bill says, can you talk about age-related degenerative joint disease?
So that is also kind of rheumatology adjacent as well. I mean, back before there were as many diagnosable autoimmune diseases and before there were so many targeted therapies for all these autoimmune diseases, I think rheumatologists saw even more of what he's describing, which is osteoarthritis, which is kind of age-related wear and tear arthritis. So it is the most common form of arthritis. It is the number one cause of joint disability in the United States and worldwide. It is unfortunately quite common, and we have no really effective medicine for preventing it. So it's it's quite a complicated condition as much as it gets brushed off in the general community. So for an example, the knee is a common location for osteoarthritis. The people's knees degenerate over time. That's a known thing. There's a lot of causes of that. Some people's knees degenerate quicker than others. Certainly trauma, weight, lots of different things can contribute to that. Unfortunately, we don't have a medicine to prevent that. So osteoarthritis is definitely a pinch of prevention is worth a pound of cure sort of condition. And the treatments that we use for pain are a lot of things people would know, which is like topical medicines like Voltaren. We use NSAIDs, which is like ibuprofen and naproxen. We do injections into the joint to try to help with the symptoms, but really none of that makes the joint better. It makes the person's joint feel better.
Yeah.
And the long-term answer to something like knee osteoarthritis in terms of fixing it is having a joint replacement. So that's the number one cause of people having joint replacements.
Lakshay writes in, says, please say hi to Dr. Allen. So apparently you know Lakshay. My question is, many people think joint pain is just aging, and we're just talking about this. When should someone actually see a rheumatologist?
So most primary care doctors are going to be effective at treating osteoarthritis, and really in terms of degenerative joint pain that gets worse with activity, that is not associated with swelling, that is not associated with significant stiffness, is going to be managed either by primary care or by an orthopedist, really. I mean, orthopedics does a lot of intra-articular things, meaning injections and kind of pain management techniques to try to make the joints better. And then, of course, if the joint is not viable anymore, then they will replace it. So that generally will not come to rheumatology, although it does sometimes come through. But really, in most cases, primary care is going to manage that.
All right. Lisa writes in, Lisa from Gardner, and then we'll go back to the phones. I have been on Humira for over a decade. It's been a miracle drug for my psoriatic arthritis. The plan I was on last year stopped covering it. I did find a plan this year that would cover it, but I'm afraid that I may be forced to use a biosimilar next year. What's your experience with Humira biosimilars? And that's from Lisa and Gardner.
That's a really good question, and I'm happy it came up. So biosimilars should be thought of as the generics of biologic medications. So just like you would be used to, you know, going on to a generic form of for example, an antibiotic or a regular, you know, a cholesterol drug. So, for example, Lipitor is the brand and atorvastatin is the generic. Biologic medications such as Humira are very expensive to produce. And in the United States, the patent laws around biologics allow them to be on patent for a very long period of time, much longer than the standard medications, in an effort to encourage industry to keep producing them so that they're economically viable. In Europe, those protections are not as strong, and they've been using biosimilars, which are essentially so Humira is adalimumab is the molecule. They've been using adalimumab biosimilars for 10 or 15 years in Europe, and the data would tell you that they are absolutely equivalent to the use of Humira. So most insurance plans will be switching. So Humira fell off patent, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. There are now like 15 biosimilars of adalimumab, and I would tell you that the data would say, and people I have seen who I've prescribed those medications for do just as well on biosimilars as they do on Humira. So I would not be afraid of them.
How long do the patents last?
I believe 20 years, although I don't quote
me on that. Fair enough. I'll do that on the copyright forum in a couple of weeks. The number here is 800-348-2551. I got to be honest, Doc, we have so many emails, we'll never get through all of them. And the thing is, you should probably come back at some point because there are a lot of questions. All right, let's go to Round Lake. Emily, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I was diagnosed with Sjogren's syndrome about 3 or 4 years ago, but I feel like I've had it for 20 years or so. But I'm calling about low-dose naltrexone. I'm just reading about that on the web, and I'm wondering what that does.
So yeah,
how does it help?
So Sjogren's syndrome is a condition that causes a lot of dryness, ocular dryness, eye dryness, mouth dryness. It's a relatively common autoimmune disease, and unfortunately, there's not really
Nobody
great medicine.
Nobody speaks that much about it.
Yeah, I think that's because there's not a ton of great medicine for it. It does tend to be managed with, you know, local treatments for dry mouth and dry eye. It does tend to cause a lot of joint and muscle pain. Low dose naltrexone is not a immune system medicine. It's really a pain medication that has gained some steam. It's quite safe in terms of treating chronic muscle and joint pain in a variety of conditions, not just Sjogren's. I'll tell you that my experience with low-dose naltrexone is sort of variable, which is the case with almost all medicines for joint and muscle pain. For some people, I've seen it work pretty well. It's quite safe. I certainly don't think it's a terrible idea for most people because there's not a ton of downside. But I will also tell you there's lots of people I've seen have no benefit with it. So it's variable.
I have a lot of joint and muscle pain. And yes. I can't really do that much. I can't be that active because when I am, I'm
it
in
hurts.
A lot of pain.
Yeah.
And I can't move around very good.
Yes. So that's something that comes
just
up.
Just curious.
Yeah, I certainly think low-dose naltrexone is a reasonable, quite safe option to try to see. And I always, you know, tell people, because this is a common issue, right? It's like you go to the doctor and they say, you know, we want you to move more. And they say, well, I can't move as much because my joints hurt. And that's kind of the cycle that is very difficult to break out of. You do need to move. So that is, I agree with that, General. And then the idea of something like low-dose naltrexone or some medication like that is going to be, the whole idea of going on it is not to obviously cure all of the pain in your body, but is to allow you to be able to move so that you are able to exercise and move around more and have a higher quality of life.
Thanks a lot for that one. Let's go now to Richard, who is on the road. Richard, where are you on the road? Oh, you got to turn the radio down, buddy. Oh, this is bad. Sorry about Mike Bowen, our engineer, is... I'm sorry, Richard. I got to let you go. Listen, if you're in the car and you got the radio on, it's just not going to work when you're on the phone. And I apologize. Richard's been waiting a long time. Let's go to Randy in Cohoes. Randy, hello.
All right, Ray. First, I owe you an apology. I had a lie to your screener. I don't have a question on arthritis, but I felt compelled to call in. And all I want to say is Dr. Michael Allen, I don't know about his poker playing, but he's an exceptional doctor, and I want to congratulate him for making this is the big time, doctor. You have made the big time on the show, and it's I don't know. There's no stopping him now, I don't think.
Wow, man. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it very much. Now, let me ask you a question. How much did he lose to you at the poker table?
Yeah, so I don't think I know a Randy in Cahoes.
Really?
Maybe I guess if he lied to the screener, he could have been from somewhere else.
He's a regular. He's a good guy. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's now go to Olive Bridge. Ron, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Hello, yeah. I'm 3 months into being into my 84th year. I just got diagnosed about 6-7 months ago with rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm on methotrexate. How long am I on that for?
So, first, rheumatoid arthritis is a condition that can be diagnosed. Although a lot of autoimmune diseases are more common in younger people, rheumatoid arthritis is a condition that is frequently diagnosed in people's 60s, 70s, and even their 80s. So that's not out of the realm of normalcy. The general thinking in rheumatoid arthritis is that you're on medicine for life because it is not curable.
For life. Okay, yeah. Okay, I got it.
Sorry,
Ron. Thanks for the call. Another satisfied customer. Barbara in Del Mar. Barbara, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I have Hashimoto's disease, and it came on when I was 28 after the birth of my first child. And I'm adopted, so it's genetic roulette. I had no idea. I'd never had a baby before, so I just thought I was exhausted because of that. I lost all energy, and then finally I went to the doctor, and he pointed out that I had a big goiter. So my concern is, do I need to worry about this for my daughter? Because she just got married, and her thyroid is borderline, but the doctor said it's okay. So will this happen to her?
So Hashimoto's is a very common autoimmune disease, and I don't know the number in terms of the prevalence in the United States. And the reason is that although we do a lot of autoimmune diseases, endocrine kind of handles the thyroid and sugar diseases, so that'd be like diabetes and thyroid disease. The answer is that I'll give you a generic answer, which is that the likelihood of the child of a person with Hashimoto's, or really most autoimmune diseases, the chances of the child having the condition is generally going to be at least a little bit higher than the general community. But for a condition like Hashimoto's, I mean, it sounds like she gets screened regularly. She already had the labs. It's really diagnosed through lab work unless she develops symptoms. It sounds like she's already certainly very aware of the condition because you have it and you've spoken to her about it. So if all of a sudden she's, having, night sweats or feels very cold or constipation, diarrhea, something like that, then someone's going to check her for it. So I don't think she needs to be, like, constantly screened for Hashimoto's. Probably annual lab would be reasonable in that circumstance.
Barbara.
Okay, and I'm just curious, why because of the child does it come on after the birth of a child?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I meant to circle on that. That's pretty common, so there is a reason for that. So because these diseases are immune system diseases, you have to think that when the normal immune system has to be mildly suppressed during pregnancy, because remember that the normal immune system, its job is to protect the individual for whom it is providing protection and get rid of everything else, viruses, bacteria, et cetera. And when you are pregnant, the baby is not you. It's, 50% your genetics, but it's 50% the genetics of someone else, and it's absolutely not you. So evolutionarily, if the immune system worked normally through pregnancy, it would not be compatible with biology because it would get rid of the baby. So the immune system is suppressed a little bit during pregnancy. And then after the baby is born, the mom's immune system does return, and often, especially because that is young women in almost all cases, the immune system comes back in an aggressive manner. It's very common for immune system diseases to be diagnosed in the first few months after delivery of a baby. So if you're having, I mean, it's very common, of course, after a delivery for a woman to have joint pain, swelling, rash, whatever. But certainly if it's out of the level of normalcy, like where the mom is not able to get out of bed and the hands are swollen, that person's should be screened for an autoimmune disease. It's not that they just are tired and, having pain from the baby.
Barbara, thanks a lot. Let's go now to Western Massachusetts. Judy, you're on with Dr. Michael Allen.
Thank you for taking my call. When I was a child, I had rheumatic fever at the age of 4. Now that I'm 77 and the aches and pains are here, are any of those related to the illness as a child, or is this just osteoarthritis?
So hard to know for certain. So rheumatic fever is a immune system disease that's in reaction to a bacterial infection, and it was more common before treatment for streptococcal infections was more available. Still see rheumatic fever, but it's certainly much less common than it once was. The reality is probably a combination of both. I mean, usually conditions that cause inflammation in the joints leave some residual damage in the joints, even if you don't feel that when you're 15, 16, you know, in your 20s. So probably there's some residual effect of the joint issues that you had back then. Having said that, the majority is probably from, you know, run-of-the-mill typical arthritis. It's going to be hard to tease out what's what, but and honestly, it doesn't make a huge difference at the end of the day as far as how you're managed. But I guess my answer to that is probably some of it's from the rheumatic fever.
All right, Judy, thanks a lot. You know, Lou Costello, one of my idols, had, as a child, rheumatic fever, and it allegedly damaged his heart. What does it do?
So it's a condition when you get a bacterial infection, streptococcal infection, you develop all these antibodies, these proteins that can cause inflammation in a variety of places, and that includes the heart, and it can cause conduction abnormalities and lead to people having heart block and needing pacemakers and medicines to manage the heart rhythm. So the heart manifestations are the most serious manifestations of that condition. Fortunately, in the what I would call the antibiotic era, it's certainly much less common, but not never. You still see it.
Okay. You know, just to check on how old I am, do you know who Lou Costello is?
That person does not come immediately
okay,
to
me. There you go. All right, we don't have time for another call, but let's do an email. This is from Christine. My primary care doctor has been saying that my blood work shows a marker for an autoimmune disease, and thus I should follow up with a rheumatologist. If I do that, what can I expect? I've been resistant to go in case they find a pre-existing condition. Is it best to know or not know? I have no symptoms that I know of. That's from Christine. You have about 40 seconds.
That's a great question. So there's a lot of blood tests that screen for autoimmune diseases, but a lot of those will show false positives. So it kind of depends on why the test was done. If it's a primary care doctor that's just kind of checking it for the sake of maybe family history or, you know, the sake of doing it and not because of any symptoms, then the likelihood that that positive test is going to result in you being diagnosed with any disease is fairly low. So I'm not going against what your doctor's saying, but if, for example, the most common of these tests is something called an ANA or an anti-nuclear antibody, about 15% of adults have a positive anti-nuclear antibody. So if it's just checked routinely in the blood, you'll find a lot of positive ones, and it's honestly not going to mean a whole heck of a lot. You'll go see the rheumatologist. They'll check out your joints. They might check a few more blood tests, and then they'll say there's nothing more to do here. Obviously, if you have symptoms, you know, joint pain, swelling, rash, fever, that's very different and would dramatically increase the likelihood that the test meant something.
Well, Doc, that's it. That's all the time we have for you. You've done very well. And I don't know if you don't run away screaming, maybe you come back, because we have so many emails and so many people left on the line. We just couldn't get to them all.
Well, thank you, everybody, and thanks for having me. I'd be happy to come back.
Great job. Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwungunks, near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency waitlist available. WoodlandPondNP.org. Thanks to Dr. Michael Allen of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Again, a million apologies if we didn't get to yours. We will do this topic again. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Bowen, and Jim Mountier took the calls today. Thanks, Jim. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it'll be Cars with Gordon Fricke. It's always a popular one. Yeah, you know what? Just call now and wait for like 23 hours, and we'll talk to you tomorrow at 2:00.